Alan Mickey.
Well, as an American, I'm on what you here in Britain call a rather sticky wicket because of this. You remember, of course, uppermost in your mind, the gross failure of the Gallup poll to predict accurately the results of the last United States presidential election, and therefore public opinion polls in general have fallen into a certain amount of disrepute. with certain qualifications, that I'm not a congressman or an MP, which I may add, thank God, I would say that within limits, particularly in running an enterprise that has any relations with the public, that I, in my own experience, have found them extremely helpful. I would certainly read them. I would definitely act upon them. I would not ignore them if they were in the field of what we call market research. In trying to determine a trend of public opinion or a public reception to a product or an idea or to a piece of goods, I think that within a degree, they have proved remarkably accurate. I don't think, and since I'm in the business, not being a congressman or an MP, but being in the business of trying to assess somewhat the same trend that congressmen and MPs try to do, I should say that I would be most suspicious of any public opinion poll which tried to give me within a matter of 1 or 2% an accurate tabulation of how a nation of 50 to 150 million people might vote. That, I think, has to be treated with a great deal of salt.
I think Alan Mickey has put his finger on it here with Mary Agnes Hamilton. They both have, and I suspect the other two members would agree with them, but it depends entirely what the survey is for. And now, just about halfway through our program, may I remind you that you're listening to the British American Brains Trust, which is coming to you from the studios of the BBC in London. Now, one more quickie. It comes from someone in Grosse Pointe, Michigan. The question is a short one. Does the Brains Trust agree that life begins at 40? Alan Mickey?
Well, I suspect, David Lloyd-James, just looking around me, that I may be the only member of the Brains Trust that is still on the near side of 40. therefore, I beg to be excused on this, because if I felt that life began at 40, then I can hardly wait with anticipation. And if I felt that conversely, life was over at 40, then I feel that I better devote the remaining few years that I've got to making the best possible use of them. I turn that question over to somebody more qualified to answer.
Yes, I don't think I can offer you any guidance here either.
Sir, let's ask someone else. Stuart Wilson.
I suppose now I've got to pose as a sort of grandfather of the party and admit to being in my 62nd year. What was I doing at 40? Well, it's so long ago, I can scarcely remember. But I'm quite certain that is wrong, that life begins at 40. What begins at 40 is your power of telling the other fellow to go to hell. And that is part of the pleasures of life, because you know where you are.
Would you like to comment on that?
Well, I'm quite outside Alan Mickey's category, I know. But I certainly don't think life begins at 40. It begins long before that and goes on beginning all the time. I mean, it's not a thing which starts at a given point. If you're alive, you are awake to new experiences all the time. Heavens, one has to wait to 40 to begin one's life. It's a terrible waste of the years before.
Dr. Hill?
Yes, I suspect there's someone in Grosse Pointe, Michigan, 40. We're all apt to take our own age and as a sort of self-comfort, tell ourselves that life's beginning at the age we happen to be. It's nonsense, of course. I want to be biological and tell you exactly when life does begin. But to think of those marvellously irresponsible, riotous years in the early 20s and to pretend that they're of no account, what nonsense it is.
Well, agreed, I think, that the sooner life begins, the better. Now, an American who is now working in London has sent us in this query. A preacher in Britain was reported to have said recently that he would rather see the world overrun by communism than face a third world war.
rather see the world overrun by communism than face a third world war. Is this by any means a general view in Britain? Mary Agnes Hamilton.
This happens to be a subject on which I feel passionately. This is not a general view in Britain. It is the very reverse of a general view in Britain. I think I speak as a typical Britisher when I say that, terrible as the horrors of a Third World War would be, the thought of domination by a force which, in its action on the life and hopes of individuals, is worse than the one we defeated in Nazi Germany, the thought of that would nerve everyone in Britain to face whatever may be coming in the way of in the cost of resistance.
Thank you.
Well, there's nothing to add to that. I'm sure Mary Agnes Hamilton is absolutely right that only by the tiniest of minorities in this country.
Alan Mickey?
Well, I would certainly agree with that as a reporter, that is. Not speaking as a British citizen or subject. I do want to add one note of caution, which is by no means a qualification of my agreement, that all but the tiniest numerical majority of British people would certainly suffer the horrors of a Third World War rather than see the world overrun by communism. But I do want to say this, that it doesn't necessarily mean, and Americans must not take it to mean, that such an attitude on the part of Britain implies a general condemnation of every Russian point of view or attitude. There's a vast difference between the American, the general American point of view and the British point of view on that subject. It doesn't mean, as it can so dangerously mean in America, when we accept the fact that we will not permit communism to advance farther or beyond a line of containment, it does not mean, as far as Britain is concerned, in my own opinion as an observer, that the British people therefore ipso facto believe that the Russians are entirely in the wrong on every single issue, and that we on the Allied or United Nations Atlantic Community side are completely in the right. I believe that there's much more feeling in Britain that if there's a mote in the Russian eye, there may possibly be just a tiny beam in our own.
Thank you for that distinction. Mrs. Chert.
We have a popular old ballad in this country called The Vicar of Bray, which described how in the 18th century a man was prepared to change his politics and swallow any creed so long as he could keep his job. I presume this preacher is looking for the vicarship of Bray in the next generation. And I wish him all pleasure in his preferment. He will not obviously join the early Christians in the arena with the lions. He would rather not stand up for his views, which, if he is a preacher and if he is a person who belongs to an organized church, he presumably has many very strong strictures about communism. But he will accept it rather than the evil which he knows already. In that case, I should recommend him to go and have a look at the Colosseum in Rome and see where his ancestors in his faith suffered.
Thank you indeed. The Brains Trust is unanimous on this question. This is by no means a general view in Britain. We pass to the next question, which comes from a man in Dayton, Ohio. If you were sentenced, he says, to a year's solitary confinement, I don't think there's any area of pensée here, by the way, if you were sentenced to a year's solitary confinement with access to pen and paper, or a library containing only detective novels, which would you choose? Pen and paper or the library containing only detective novels? Alan Mickey.
Well, obviously, as an author, I would choose pen and paper, and to make the answer very short, as an author who's now two books behind to his publisher, I would definitely choose pen and paper. And in fact, the one thing that I might look forward to is a year's solitary confinement.
I had a considerable time once in a hospital.
in which I had ample opportunity. I was not solitary confined, indeed, but I was confined. I had ample opportunity to write or to read. I read a detective story every morning and a military biography every evening. I think on the whole that if I were confined, I would like detective novels because they might teach me how not to be confined the next time.
Or how to get out. Dr. Hill?
Well, I confess that as one who dictates most of his stuff and uses his Vira only for signing letters, I should much prefer to have an assortment of detective novels, for I should soon get tired of writing and describing the grim surroundings in which I was placed.
Mary Agnes Hamilton?
Well, I find myself confronted with a horrid choice between theory and practice. In theory, what I want to do and what I know I ought to do is to accept with glee a period of solitary confinement in which I could write the book, the book, which I have never written. But in point of fact, if I were solitarily confined, I should clamour for every detective novel in the library.
The Brains Trust, I think I may safely to say, is not looking forward to this year of solitary confinement. So let me utter a fervent hope that it will not take place. And now, an inquisitive American, perhaps a sociologist, at present on a visit to London, would like a quick answer to this question. A quick answer, because it's got to be our last. If I gave each of you a pound, it's an unlikely assumption, I must say. If I gave each of you a pound, that is about $3.
That's also an unlikely assumption, too.
Yes. Let's go back to the beginning. If I gave each of you a pound, that is about $3, and told you to spend it straight away, what would you spend it on and why?
If you Dr. gave Hill. Me a pound, having recovered from my astonishment, I should buy 2 ounces of Edgeworth tobacco for 19 and 6 pence, give the 6 pence to my youngest child, and conceal the price from my wife.
Excellent. Yes.
I should ask him if instead of $3, he'd send me a Virginia ham.
Well, you won't get much Virginia ham for $3, Sir Stuart.
Oh, dear.
If I were given a pound with that choice, I think perhaps I would buy a book. Not just any book, but one of a number of books which, when I have the leisure and, I may say, the pounds, I would like to add to my library. The fact that I've got several thousand books in the library that I haven't had time to read doesn't alter the fact that in time, if I spent your pound on the book, I would be able to read it and get the enjoyment out of it that at the moment I'm only able to anticipate.
Thank you, Alan Mickey. Mary Hamilton?
I would buy a ticket for the Sadler's Wells Ballet if it happened to be at Covent Garden. At the moment, it happens to be in the United States, so I should have to hoard my dollars till they come back.
Could the American sociologists give us the Brains Trust a pound and let's all go out and have a drink?
I think that's the sensible suggestion. It answers our questioner. You can choose between Edgeworth, Virginia ham, a book, or a ticket, thereby enabling yourself to choose between smoking, eating, reading, or watching. Now, that brings an end to our program. If you have a question for the panel here in London, would you send it, please, to the British American Brains Trust, Broadcasting House, London, England. The British American Brains Trust, Broadcasting House, London, England. And we shall be very glad to discuss it. Now, on behalf of Mary Agnes Hamilton, Sir Stuart Wilson, Alan Mickey, and Dr. Charles Hill, this is David Lloyd James saying goodbye to you from the studios of the BBC in London.
You have been listening to the British American Brains Trust. The speakers were Mary Agnes Hamilton, Sir Stuart Wilson, Dr. Charles Hill, and Alan Mickey. The question master was David Lloyd James. This is the British Broadcasting Corporation.